Hi, I'm Dr. Hillary McBride. Normally, therapy sessions are totally confidential, but in other people's problems, I open the doors to let you hear sessions with my long-standing clients. This is what people sound like when they talk with someone they trust about healing addiction, parenting stress, racist ideologies in the family, and other topics that feel so timely as we come through this difficult time. Other People's Problems, available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman. This is White Coat Blackheart. Despite wishes to the contrary, the pandemic is not quite finished, at least according to the World Health Organization. This week, the WHO decided not to lift its declaration of COVID as a public health emergency of international concern. That declaration was made 3 years ago. In those panicky first days of the pandemic, a lack of PPE and concerns about COVID spreading at hospitals and clinics led to this seismic shift in the way health professionals met their patients.
Doctors are allowed to use technological platforms like Zoom to do medical visits. That could save people a lot of travel. In our case, it would save them $12 on parking.
Early in the pandemic, provinces like Ontario began paying doctors the in-person fee, $37, to see patients online. New virtual clinics flourished. In one study, virtual visits went up 5,600%, while the in-person kind dropped by nearly 80%. But that was then. 2 months ago, Ontario dropped its virtual per-visit fee from $37 to just $20. The province says it did that to encourage more visits in the flesh. The people who operated 17 virtual-only clinics in the province have either packed up or are considering it. Our show this week is about those Canadians who say virtual clinics are filling a huge and growing gap in our healthcare system.
Hi, my name is Shauna Ford. I live in Strathmore, Alberta. It's either 30 minutes or an hour away from Calgary, depending on how you drive.
Shauna, who is 62, moved to Strathmore in 2014, but decided to keep her Calgary doctors when she learned that the MDs in her new home weren't taking on new patients. That and some chronic conditions have made virtual appointments her go-to. Can you take me back to when your health first deteriorated? What happened?
It was a lot of things, but in 2008, I found a small bump on my cheek, and it turned out to be cancer of the salivary gland. But there was also a lot of things that happened within a few months, from divorce to overwork to even having the flu. I definitely crashed and ended up with major depressive disorder.
But the salivary gland cancer was successfully treated?
Yeah, it was diagnosed and treated with surgery. It didn't require any radiation or any kind of chemotherapy.
And you've been clear of that ever since?
For sure. It's been great.
That's great. So how has your health been lately?
This past year has been really interesting. I was managed to get a referral to the Mood Disorder Clinic at the Foothills Hospital for treatment-resistant depression. And in that process of doing a deep review, discovered I'm autistic, and possibly from the flu I mentioned in 2008, I have ME, which explains a lot of the fatigue.
ME stands for myalgic encephalomyelitis. It's a disabling illness with symptoms that include trouble concentrating, pain, dizziness, problems sleeping, and fatigue.
Getting clear diagnosis has really helped with managing my depression and, in particular, my fatigue.
So, Shauna, given all of those issues, how has virtual care made a difference to both your general and mental health?
Well, I live in a town out outside of Calgary, and when I moved here, there were no new physicians, and my own physician was great, so I would have to travel. So it would be about an hour to where my appointment was. And so in order to do, like, having the phone appointments for routine prescription renewals and other questions, it's just saved so much of my energy. Because normally to go into the city, I don't do anything the day before. I don't do anything a few days after because it totally drains me. So having those phone appointments is amazing. And the Zoom appointments with a psychiatrist have also just freed up so much of my energy that I can use, you know, in things that I want to do. And yes, I do go in person when required.
And under what circumstances would that be?
I had a reaction to a medication, so the psychiatrist wanted to see me in person.
And, you know, there was a time when virtual appointments were almost non-existent. Would you say at this point in time that you actually prefer virtual appointments?
Because I'm on disability, my income is below the poverty line. So every drive is wear and tear on my car. Paying for parking is a burden. You know, energy-wise, I can say that I have delayed appointments because I was just too tired, or the highway was, you know, icy with a blizzard and things. So virtual care just is that step in healthcare that's very much, I feel, sensitive to myself as a patient with that needs accommodations.
Shauna, so what do you make of the fact that some provincial governments have been cutting funding for virtual walk-in care?
I find that really surprising, because one of the few benefits that COVID brought to our society was the advancement of virtual care. And I'm not a pro-COVID by any stretch, but COVID sped up the access, the accessibility. It gave us a new look at how our physicians can take care of us. It needs to be expanded in all provinces, and especially if you don't have a regular, like I'm really fortunate, if you don't have a regular physician, it just makes so much sense to allow this service so people don't have to go to the ER to seek basic care.
It sounds like you think there's a balance that can be struck between virtual appointments and in-person appointments.
Oh, definitely. I think patients and providers know the difference. And when the patient doesn't know that they need an in-person, the provider will let them know. I think there's a lot of wisdom in what patients know about their own body and, of course, the skills that physicians bring. And there's no advantage to restricting virtual care based on arbitrary guidelines. It's still about the relationship between, you know, myself as a patient and my healthcare provider.
So, Shauna, do you believe that the provinces are cutting back on virtual care without considering the patient's point of view, what the patient might have wanted?
In my work as a patient family advisor, we're encouraged to tell our stories, and I've been one of the people that don't tell my story that often. So I'm also using this as stepping outside my comfort zone. And quite often, patients are the last to be asked about what is important.
Last question I want to ask you, Shauna. Why are you speaking out in defense of virtual care? It's one thing to want it. It's another thing to speak out in favor of it.
I want to speak out because a lot of patients don't know that they actually have a voice. And as a patient and as a family member with patients, we need to learn how to say what actually is useful for us.
It's a big step. Shauna Ford, I wanted to thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Shauna Ford doesn't have to worry about losing access to virtual appointments. That's because the Alberta government continues to provide online medical services. But in Ontario, the impact of that province's move to cut doctors' fees for virtual appointments has started to be felt.
Hi, my name is Dr. Aviva Lowe, and I'm a Toronto-based pediatrician. I practice largely consulting-based pediatrics, as well as lactation or breastfeeding medicine. In addition to that,
Dr. Aviva Lowe is a pediatrician who has seen lots of children who are underserved by the healthcare system. She's on staff at Kix Care, a virtual clinic serving kids. Kix Care is one of the virtual clinics in Ontario that started up during the pandemic. Most have either closed or are close to shuttering since December, when the Ontario government cut the fee for virtual visits. The province and the Ontario Medical Association say that they've done this. They've recommended this reduction in the fee for virtual visits to get people to go back to having appointments with their doctor. In your case, a pediatrician, could be a family doctor, face-to-face. What do you say about that?
The vast majority of children that I saw through Kix Care did not need a follow-up in-person appointment. More than 90% of the visits to Kicks Care in general resolved with that virtual, the issue resolved rather with that virtual visit, meaning that a follow-up in-person visit was not indicated or needed. And I can actually, you know, count on one or two hands the number of times that I sent a child to the ER. It was extraordinarily rare. On the other hand, parents reported when polled by Kicks Care that the vast majority of them would have gone to the ER, but for the opportunity to see a pediatrician virtually through Kicks Care.
What were the kinds of problems that you addressed that you think those patients and their parents could get into a lot of trouble without your services?
It really runs the gamut, ranging from children who were sick with some type of viral or other infectious illness, who had a cough or congestion or diarrhea or vomiting, and I was able to assess the urgency of their condition and provide guidance on next steps to help them get through it. Again, these are families that, you know, mid-weekend or late at night or, you know, all alone without access to any other doctor would otherwise be going to the emergency room. A teenager who has been experiencing debilitating anxiety and or depression, you know, throughout the pandemic and has had nowhere to turn for help and has been suffering at home. Family learned of access to pediatrician this way, and all of a sudden the door opened for them to get help, to have someone listen, to have someone help manage their mental health journey and to get them on, you know, on the right track, whether it would be connecting them with resources, with counseling services, with psychiatry, or with initiating medication as indicated. And then along with that, there were many, many times when I would be seeing a family who was concerned about their young child, their toddler, who wasn't reaching his or her milestones, who was not speaking, who had developmental challenges, and they didn't know how they could possibly access an assessment and how to get the ball rolling to understand what the issue was and to help provide support for their child, to help them reach their potential and make gains.
Dr. Lowe says the collateral damage from cutting the fee for virtual visits is being felt by patients who don't have access to primary care. The ones she saw at Kicks Care include kids who were born with developmental challenges and teens with severe mental health problems.
These changes have really created two classes of Ontarians when it comes to accessing virtual care. And by that I mean there's the group of patients who can continue to access it, and those are patients who can access it with their own doctor or with a consultation to another doctor. And those patients are already better resourced from a healthcare perspective than the other group, which is those that already don't have their own doctor. They don't have a doctor with whom to have any care, in-person care or virtual care. And those are the ones who are being further disadvantaged with these recent changes. And in a publicly funded healthcare system such as ours, creating two classes of patients when it comes to accessing virtual care, in my view, is highly inequitable.
The public debate over virtual care seems to have, or at least by the headlines in the media, has pitted healthcare providers against one another, those in favor of more open and liberal access to virtual care and those who aren't. How much do you think the system is concerned with what patients themselves want and need?
In my view, I don't think the system has their finger on the pulse of what patients need and want, because if it did, we wouldn't be in this predicament. All of those families, you know, were left without being able to continue that care with me, that care that we had ongoing for months. We had a pre-existing doctor-patient relationship. It just didn't fall into the definition of pre-existing or established relationship that was set out by the Ministry of Health and the current iteration of the physician services agreement.
We're talking a lot about systems, and I want to bring it back to the patients. What's at stake for, you know, a child with developmental abnormalities who needs a complex workup and needs a lifeline, someone to begin to help them navigate through a complicated system? What's at stake for a teen with a new mental health problem who lives in a remote area and doesn't have access to good primary care?
The stakes are very high. In your example of a child with complex developmental challenges, really time is of the essence. There is a window where intervention done early and in a timely fashion can make a bigger difference than if it were delayed or never happened. And that can affect a child's entire life. You know, for the child or teen with significant mental health challenges, access to care, access to support, access to therapies is crucial. It can literally mean life and death. You know, we're on the heels of Bell Let's Talk Day, and there's lots of talk in the news about the importance of talking about mental health problems, reaching out for support when you're struggling. But if somebody is at their home suffering in a remote part of the province, or frankly, even in an urban area where mental health resources for children and adolescents are still limited and there's still lengthy waiting lists, no doctor, no one to have them referred, assessed, or treated, the stakes are very high. As we all know, things can spiral downhill very quickly and with devastating consequences.
We'll be right back.
Okay, don't skip ahead. I'm going to talk to you about climate change. And I know it can get depressing or infuriating, but our show takes a different approach. It's Laura Lynch, and I'm the host of What on Earth, and we're all about solutions and hope. And I promise, no matter how overwhelming climate change might feel, we're with you on the journey to fix this mess. So listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to White Coat Black Guard. This week, a look at virtual medical appointments. They were very popular at a time during the pandemic when in-person visits were discouraged. Now, the pendulum is swinging back to in-person. And not a moment too soon, says one expert.
Hi, how are you doing? I'm Brian.
Decided to get the exercise.
Well, good for you. Well, I went running very early this morning, but
So do you want to take the stairs or do you want to take the elevator?
Let's take the stairs. Why don't you first of all give me a hi, my name is, and tell us what you do here and where we are.
Yeah, I'm Tara Kieran. I'm a family doctor at St. Michael's Hospital and also a researcher here. I hold a leadership role at our university as well, and I'm here at the Lee Keshing Knowledge Institute at St. Michael's Hospital, where I have a research office, and I look forward to talking to you about virtual care and in-person care.
We follow each other on Twitter. Is this the first time we've met?
I think so.
It's great to meet you in person.
Dr. Tara Kieran is both a family doctor and a health policy guru. She researches how changes in the healthcare system impact the most vulnerable in society. Her research includes the stunning growth in virtual appointments.
Dr. Tara Kieran, welcome to White Coat Black Guard.
Thanks, Brian. It's lovely to be here.
You're a family physician who studies ways to improve primary care. So make the case for having in-person visits with a family physician or a nurse practitioner?
Well, family medicine is all about building relationships with people. We have lots of evidence over many years from many different countries that show that when someone has a continuous relationship with one family doctor, their outcomes are going to be better. They're going to use the healthcare system less. They're going to get more of the kinds of tests and care that are recommended for them. And actually, health system costs overall go down as well. And there's even evidence that mortality is improved. So lots of evidence supporting a strong relationship. And I would say, Brian, that relationship, I think, a strong relationship, as we know as human beings, really, I think, has to include in-person connection. There's something very different about meeting someone in three dimensions, looking them in the eye, holding space for them when they're going through a tough time. the body language, the small touches on the arm even to reassure someone. So that's just a therapeutic connection. But of course, then there's all the medical reasons.
You can't feel a belly for tenderness virtually, not yet at least.
Absolutely. You know, most people, when they have an acute problem in particular, so that means a new problem, we need to usually examine them. And some things can be silent and people can't perceive them. So, for example, you know, blood pressure. You know, it's true people can do some of their blood pressure at home, but when we bring them in, we have more confidence on the accuracy in terms of the way that we do it. And, you know, we can take a look at their feet, which maybe they aren't able to feel. But then when they come in with a new problem, like a earache or sore throat, we can actually look in the ears and say, do you have an ear infection? Do you have something that might look like strep throat? Let's listen to your lungs. Does it sound like you might have a pneumonia? Those are things that we can't do effectively except in person.
You recently published what I think is an important study because it adds to our understanding of what happens after, you know, following a virtual appointment. Can you talk about that study, what the main highlights were?
Yeah, so we recently published a paper that looked at virtual-only walk-in clinics. And we looked at the types of physicians who work there, the types of patients, but then we looked at also what happened to the patients after they had an appointment with this virtual-only service. And what we found is that patients who had an appointment with a virtual-only service, they had two times the odds of going to the emergency department compared to patients in Ontario who saw any family doctor for a virtual visit. So not their own family doctor, but any family doctor working in any other setting.
Well, that's interesting. So what do you make of that? I mean, you know, you don't want to go beyond the scope of the study. I'm sure there's limitations that you want to talk about, but what did you conclude from that?
For me, it warned me that virtual-only services can add more fragmentation and churn in the system potentially, and we need to be careful to evaluate them carefully. It made sense that we pivoted right away to virtual care, but I think what happened is that there was a growth in these virtual-only services because people also saw a profit motive for them, to be honest, and I think they haven't been evaluated by the third parties. And I think our study, yes, it was imperfect, but we used the data that was available to us. So if you can't see somebody in person, it's not surprising that you might need to send them somewhere to have an in-person exam. And that place might end up being the emergency department. They may not say, go to the emergency department. They may just say, you need to see a doctor to actually have yourself examined. And then I think the other thing that I've heard actually anecdotally through media stories of patients telling their story is that when patients are seeing someone that they don't know who hasn't examined them and they're only seeing them virtually, they also have less trust in what it is that they're being told. They have less trust in the diagnosis and the assessment and the treatment plan. And sometimes that is totally warranted because they haven't been examined. And so then I think some of that may also be driving going to the eMERGE. So there's lots of hypotheses that are reasonable as to why they might be using the eMERGE more, to be honest. And I also want to put forward, this is not to say that these virtual services aren't meeting some need. But I think what we have to understand is, you know, all of these new things, they are getting some funding from the public system, and that's funding that can't be used for something else. And so what I put forward is, you know, we need to be careful with what we're funding to ensure that the things we're funding align with what we know people want and at the end of the day provide better outcomes. And I say people want comprehensive longitudinal primary care with someone who will see them over time and see them in person if needed. And they also want virtual options, but they also want to be seen in person. And we know that relational continuity is what provides better outcomes.
There's been other research that suggested that there was no difference in emergency department visits, but do you trust your data more?
So actually, we've done other research as well. The research that we have that's actually currently in preprint, similar research was actually just published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Our study, which I'll talk about because I know it better, really looked at the relationships between the proportion of virtual care that a family doctor provides and the amount of emergency department visits that their patient panel has. So it's a very different question than virtual-only services. And so what we found is that physicians who provided a higher portion of virtual care, they weren't more likely to have patients who go to the emergency department. That here we're talking about seeking emergency department visits and providing virtual care in the context of an ongoing primary care relationship. I will say, though, also we looked, you know, at the health system more broadly and trends over time. And what we saw is that when COVID cases went up. Emergency department visits actually went down often because people did not want to go.
I worked there, I know. Yeah. I remember that.
And virtual primary care visits went up. So it wasn't that more virtual care from family doctors meant more emergency department visits, which was kind of the narrative that was out there for a while. And so all this to say, I think virtual care has its place, Brian, but I think the place in an ideal world is within a continuous relationship with a family doctor. That, of course, gets us to the point that many people don't have a family doctor, nurse practitioner, or primary care team, and we need to address that.
Dr. Kieran says it's understandable and even laudable that virtual clinics became an important way for unattached patients, including kids, to access health care. But she thinks we're in danger of missing a much bigger need.
One of the things, though, why I worry about the growth of walk-in clinic urgent care type of medicine is that I feel like it is a Band-Aid that is growing the wound. So basically, we're trying to say, these people don't have a family doctor. Okay, go to this walk-in clinic or urgent care center. You'll get the care you need right away. Except, who's working at those walk-in clinics and urgent care centers? It's family doctors. And what are they not doing when they're working there? They're not setting up their own comprehensive longitudinal practice. And in many ways, it's easier to just work in the walk-in clinic or urgent care center. They don't have the responsibility of follow-up. They haven't had to necessarily actually do that small business part of the family practice that's a hassle. So I think that we need to rethink how our human resources are used. So yeah, let's try and think big about how we can envision it. And one of the things that I'll say, you know, in our survey that we did, 97% of people agreed that we needed to have everyone in Canada have a family doctor, NP, or primary care team. Everyone strongly agreed with that. People think it's a priority.
In an upcoming show, we'll take a closer look at how to reimagine primary care for every Canadian who wants and needs it. That's our show this week. If you'd like to comment, our email address is whitecoat@cbc.ca. Whitecoat Black Art was produced this week by returning producer Amina Zoffer with help from Jeff Goods and Stephanie Dubois. Our digital producer is Adam Killick. Technical operations were by Lauda Antonelli and Gary Francis. Our senior producer is Colleen Ross. That's medicine from my side of the gurney. I'm Brian Goldman. See you next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.